This episode is sponsored by Claude, the AI for minds that don't stop at good enough. You're listening to Pretty Much Pop, a culture podcast sentimentally catching the zeitgeist even as we trot out the same tired characters episode after episode. Today we're discussing the 1995 film Toy Story and sequels in light of the new Toy Story 5. I'm Mark Linsenmeyer, and I think a real friend would talk to your face and not just behind your back.
I'm Al Baker, cursing myself for ever throwing any of my toys away.
Howdy, I'm Sarah Lynn Brook, and yeehaw, the Roundup gang is back in town.
Oh, Sarah. This is Lawrence Ware. And anyone know why Rex is like playing basketball? Anybody? Anybody? He can't reach the rim. His arms are too short.
All right.
That's probably true.
Oh, yes. Lawrence.
There's a lot of short arms jokes. It seems like physical disability is an endless source of comedy.
It's not a disability. He's a dinosaur. Dinosaurs don't have long arms. Okay, never mind.
I mean, and the potato head's parts keep falling off.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, absolutely. I mean,
it's tragic.
Or a feature.
Mark, I intuited in your introduction that you might not have liked this film.
I'll just get it out there. I thought the new film stood up just fine, but I do have a mixed feeling about the entire series. I think it is well made. It does what it's supposed to do. I got a little teary, probably. I don't remember if I did during number four. I think people think number four is sort of a drop-off. I feel like even that it was fine. I rewatched them in more or less reverse order.
That's what I did too.
I saw number five pretty late in the game. So I was sort of like increasingly impressed, like, oh, I forgot that two was this good. I forgot that one was this good for the kind of movies that they are.
Yeah, I was going into this one with really low expectations because I saw a couple of reviews and everyone seemed very lukewarm. But now I watched the new movie and it hit all the right kind of Toy Story notes for me. And yeah, you notice a lot of very similar beats being played, especially in the most recent movie. It turns out in every single Toy Story film, the action has to basically revolve around the toys being lost and needing to find their way home again. That's fine, we can buy that. But I was surprised at how much the new movie found that was new to talk about. And it was new stuff. So the plot and the characters were treading over old ground. But the themes and the messages seem to be new and important.
I thought kind of the opposite, Al, because I thought that plot-wise, the fact that Toy Story 5 is focusing on Jesse instead of the usual gang, I thought was kind of a fresh take. And I really liked a lot of where this movie went. But emotionally, I thought it hit all of the same beats for me. Mm. I could almost guess when it was I was going to cry. And I did cry basically right at the same point that I do in every single other Toy Story movie.
I mean, I saw Minions and Monsters this week.
I'm sorry.
Actually, it was quite good, believe it or not. Like, if you know the history of Hollywood, it's actually a quite good movie, a very good movie, believe it or not. Anyway, Minions and Monsters is not the point of this podcast. I saw that, and I thought, oh, I was going to hate this movie because it's silly, same trot-out characters, same little things, same weird things. And it hit me. It was really, really good. And I thought the same thing was going to happen with Toy Story. I thought that Toy Story was going to be a film where I was like, ah, this is not going to work on me. This is silly. This is stupid. And it worked. Like, the emotional beats worked. I do think that Sarah brought up something very interesting, that it does do something different because the earlier Toy Story films focused on like a boy character and this one focused on a female character. And I thought that was very smart, a nice way to kind of play in the same playground but give a different perspective. And then as a father of kids who are coming up now, screens are a huge thing. Screen time, trying to figure out screen time. There's like a cult of screens. Like, your kid will be on the outs if he doesn't have, or she doesn't have like a screen to play with their kids and all kind of stuff. And so, Mark, I'm telling you, man, I loved it. I didn't want to love it. I didn't think that I would love it. But God damn it, if Toy Story just doesn't know how to do it. Like, it's really good storytelling. It's good screenwriting, good voice acting. The animation's beautiful. And they always do something interesting and unexpected that actually works. It's worked for me. I wanted to be grumpy film critic guy, but God damn it if I wasn't crying in the movie theater. I just was.
I felt a little like a creep going, none of my family wanted to see this because they haven't.
Oh, okay. You were that guy. You were the old guy in the back of the movie theater. That's what happened.
Yeah, but I did then therefore see it in 3D because nobody that I know likes 3D. And it was such smooth 3D. It's exactly, I saw Toy Story 3 in 3D and I had a really good experience with that. And I feel like this is the kind of 3D that does not give you headaches. It is exactly what, you know, watching humans in natural landscapes in 3D, Avatar, whatever, that can be a little jarring. Mm-hmm. But this, it's just like, you know, computer animation. It's done in 3D, you know, making them seem that more tangible. Like the fundamental reason that these films are appealing is because of the tangibility of toys. We had an action figures or a collectibles episode a long time ago on this show where I used to collect Star Wars action figures, which I am a little disappointed. Disney owns Star Wars. Disney owns all these things. Like, come on, have somebody have, you know, the 1978 vintage Greedo. How, you know, bring in some my specific nostalgia. I'm not nostalgic for cowboys. I don't know anybody, even when I was a kid, who played cowboys. That's like kids in the 50s playing cowboys. So
yeah, Toy Story is only allowed to use Mattel IP still for some reason.
It does seem that Toy Story is kind of stuck in a different time in a lot of ways. Mm. I was listening to an interesting conversation about kids and play and how Toy Story interprets how kids play. And it just seemed, even in Toy Story 5, and as much as I've liked all five movies, by the way, even four, I've enjoyed every single one of them. But it does seem the way that they think of play as a little bit reductive, that kids are only kind of supposed to play one way, and that involves your imagination, and that involves physicality, you know, physical objects. And as if you couldn't use your imagination when you're playing a game like Minecraft or something. I watched my own kid create these entire worlds in a video game that I didn't even really understand. But I thought it was extremely creative. And I really loved the fact that she loved that game and got so much out of it and still talks about it fondly. And I just found that Toy Story just kind of has a very limited scope on how kids are kind of supposed to play. And I wondered if it's because of who the creators are and that's how they played. And
yeah,
that's how they wished that their kids played. But anyway, that's probably my one big quibble with this franchise is how they view play.
I think that's a really, really strong point. And I actually think the most recent film does quite a lot to address it. I mean, part of the reason why the notion of play that they're stuck in is exactly right. The first movie was made in the mid-90s.
Right.
We had, first, second generation video game consoles, not all that much to kind of write home about, and screens hadn't become the default entertainment mode.
Yeah, very true.
But I was in that kind of first generation of gamers when video games were becoming something really imaginatively fulfilling that could kind of facilitate this really kind of creative play. And a lot of ink was spilled, you know, not least by me arguing precisely this, that, you know, we shouldn't be doom and glooming about the role that video games were playing and like what they were taking away from old analog forms of play. The argument was exactly that. It is imaginatively engaging in a lot of ways, a lot more so than traditional forms of play. But the new movie, so yeah, they absolutely opened themselves up to that critique. But what I thought the new movie did, which was very, very interesting, is that even though clearly the target is like screens and devices, they are the villains, those screens don't come out at the end of the movie as completely villainous. The online kind of environment that the kids get exposed to gives that ability to connect, which would have been completely unavailable to Bonnie without the lily pad. And I think the Toy Story 5 is making a much more sophisticated argument than screens bad. It seems to me like it's talking about just think more carefully about what exactly you're trying to get from each kind of play. Mm. I think the movie is saying the mistake is not using screens. The mistake is using screens and expecting it to be able to provide everything that analog play does, which I think is a much more kind of nuanced and important point now, because it is not possible for a child to grow up without screens. But that shouldn't mean that our entire notion of play or childhood should be reformed around the digital sphere, which is the real danger.
Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what I was worried about, because the easy argument is to say screens bad, analog play good. That's the easy argument to make. And I was worried that this film would make that argument. And then, of course, Toy Story did something that I was not expecting and was smarter and said, screens are here. They're here to stay. It's not going away, but it should not replace other forms of play. It shouldn't be the only form of play. And that's something that I really appreciated. I appreciate it because, I mean, we're in a world now where you can try to take away screens from kids, but it's not going to happen. At some point, they're going to go back to those screens. That is just the primary way in which they interact, the primary way in which they play. And so I liked that it was saying, look, let's incorporate screens into our play, but not let that be the only way that you play. And I thought that was a very smart argument.
Per Sarah's point, in the final scene, the screen gets incorporated into the play qua physical object.
Mm. Right.
And just like Woody can make a sound when you pull his thing and Buzz, you know, has buttons and lights and things like that, then we can use, oh, okay, let's have the screen be the church organ, which, you know, maybe it was making some sounds in real life. Maybe it was not making some sound, but you could actually make that a prop for your physical play. Like that is a key moment in introducing these hybrid, right? They're electronic devices, but they're obsolete electronic devices. I didn't know what year this was happening in or what year was the toilet training thing based on a real product. I forgot to research that. Did Conan O'Brien personally pitch this to them?
Possibly.
Conan O'Brien, by the way, stole the movie. They gave every single funny line to that guy. And he was so hilarious. I love that character so much. But I don't remember that.
But they are used. Yeah, that they're sort of only reveal their true nature when they're played with, not according to their actual function, when they're played with qua physical object, that you could have a freaking golf ball and make that a character, as Forky showed us in the last movie. You could make any old thing and your imagination can make it into a toy that you can. So I had toy cars, but my peers would room, you know, push the cars around and make them be cars. I, having an older sister, would have the cars in a restaurant eating nuts and bolts. That was like the classic thing. So they're people. So I played the wrong way with cars, even though I guess it's imaginative either way. But like, no, they're talking bipedal cars.
I think this is one of the points the movie's trying to make as well, is that one of the dangers of screen time is it homogenizes the play, or it can very easily homogenize the kind of imaginative world that children are participating in. Because you don't get, if you're playing Minecraft, you can do anything in Minecraft, but a sheep in Minecraft is always going to stand in for a sheep. And a weapon in Minecraft is always going to stand in for a weapon. It's much harder to have the same kind of freedom to have things stand in for whatever, which is another kind of risk.
Because I noticed the same thing, Mark, is that the way that the lily pad was incorporated in sort of the triumphant final scene of playing and everybody being welcome in that space, including analog toys and electronic toys, but it was still play in the traditional sense. It just made me think of my daughter. 1 year had a birthday party where we had in every room a different video game. She wanted a video game themed birthday party. And so in the living room, we had the dance game. And then in another room, we had Minecraft. And then in another room, we had something else. And the kids bebopped from one room to the other. And it was really social. It was one of the most fun kids' birthday parties. Honestly, I'm patting myself on the back.
Yeah, you're an awesome mom. That's incredible.
Congratulations. Good job, Sarah.
Okay. But it was really fun. It was very social. The kids were using their imaginations. They're using their bodies. They're moving around. And they were having a blast. And I thought, that is just as valuable as having a pretend tea party with your friends and your dolls or your Barbies or something. I felt like that was just as valuable for those kids' brains, that form of play as anything else.
Did you give them a choice? Did you have a room that just had some stuffed animals and
no
plastic dinosaur?
No, my daughter was calling the shots. She was the one that she picked all the games. She picked, you know, where each game was going to be. And it was very successful.
I do want to draw a line between like action figures and stuffed animals. Stuffed animals were for sleeping. Who sleeps with a Buzz Lightyear? That's not comfortable. You don't want that thing.
I slept with my G.I. Joes.
Oh, I slept with plastic toys. I slept with
Who's
things that were,
rules?
That were probably, probably dangerous for a child to sleep with.
With, yeah, but I slept with a whole bunch of plastic animals. I
mean, cars plastic are things. Also allowed to go to dinner and have conversations.
I didn't sleep with the cars. I did not sleep with those cars.
I just think your childhood might have been a little bit too restrictive, Mark, because I was comfortable sleeping with my Batman action figure, sleeping with, if I remember correctly, I had G.I. Joe, Batman, and I want to say the bad G.I. Joe Cobra one that I slept with. And I was perfectly fine. I made it. I survived.
And would you have been like, oh, you're sleeping with a plush koala bear?
No.
What a pussy. You are. I'm sleeping with my G.I. Joes.
Sleep how you want to sleep, man. Sleep how you want to sleep. I'm not a sleep judger.
Just hearing before I saw the new movie about that this was going to be, a critique of these tablets, it seemed a little late. It seemed like,
yeah,
I thought so
about
too.
10 years too late. I thought the precise way in which they did it, like, of course, it's a real thing now with people with their phones and just, you know, showing the sea of faces, you know, in all the windows of there's a screen and her father is like, so it's still like to the point. And per what you guys have been saying, like, obviously there are good and bad ways to use it, and using it as a way to address anxiety and just constantly be looking down at your phone and constantly be feeling the need, which I do it myself, second screening while you're watching other things. I would be looking out for like a shitty iPad game that I don't have to concentrate on that I could sort of do to occupy my nervous fingers while I'm watching something that is maybe a little too boring for me.
So on the point of it being too late, obviously it's too late to be timely. The critical mode of Toy Story movies, if that's not too highfalutin a phrase to talk about children's movies, but the critical mode of Toy Story movies is fundamentally nostalgic. And it seems like what they're always trying to do is remind us of something that we may have forgotten about. In that case, it's probably right that they didn't make the Be Careful About Screens Toy Story movie when screens were like on the horizon or coming up or becoming important, and waited for the time when they could talk about the things that screens may have displaced or the things that the homogeneity of screens may have helped us to forget. Because what I'm reminded of, was it Toy Story 2, which was all about toys as collectibles?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the lesson of that movie was very much like toys are meant to be played with. And if you want to collect them, then fine. But remember that they're meant to fulfill this function. Yeah, so it seems like the critique is always backward-looking rather than forward-looking.
You know, it made me wonder, actually, and I'm certain I'm wrong, but in 1995, Andy was how old? He was supposed to be...
9, 10?
Like 9 or 10.
Somewhere in that age, yeah.
Somewhere in that age range.
He's going to cowboy camp. How old are you when you send your kids off for the summer?
Like fourth grade or something. Yeah, probably 9 or 10. Yeah. I think he was right around this. My youngest brother is, I think, the same age as Andy, and weirdly also named Andy. So Toy Story was a big deal in our house. But anyway, but the timeline of the movie, we know that Andy grows up, Andy goes to college. And I wonder if the timing of the movie, because something like Lily Pad, they had that out, I think, when my kid was little.
Yeah.
It feels like it's 10 or 15 years off. And I wonder if just the timeline of the franchise itself is moving at a slower pace than actual time is, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I wondered, like, when is this actually supposed to be taking place? I don't know that it matters, but there were drones, remember, in the new film.
Right. That's like, right.
There were some very modern moments.
You're totally right.
QR codes, RFID tagging. This episode is brought to you by Claude, the AI from Anthropic. You've heard me say this before, but I use Claude all the time. It keeps my business ticking over while I handle the big picture and the fun stuff. It handles the unglamorous life admin that I'd otherwise definitely leave to rot. And it gets me started on the hobbies and half-formed projects that normally never survive past the daydreaming stage. Recently, it helped me finesse a beautiful doubles team for Pokemon Champions, and finally helped me graduate to grown-up cryptic crosswords of the kind that could get me recruited as a spy in the 1940s. And the best bit is that Claude is where all this extra time to do these things comes from. The monitoring, the maintenance, the repetitive jobs that used to annex my afternoons, it takes those off me and hands those afternoons right back. If you're a developer losing half your day to work you'd rather hand off, Claude Code lives in your terminal, reads your code base, and will write your tests, take on a refactor, or chase down a bug without you holding its hand the whole way. I'm one of those people who can't really think until I'm saying it out loud to someone, which is about three quarters of why I do this podcast. But I also hate saying something within earshot of an audience that I haven't thought about properly first. If I'm going to be arguing with Lawrence, I'll want to put in some practice first, arguing with Claude. I'll watch something we're about to cover and think out loud as I go. Claude's at its best on the questions no search engine will ever answer for you. Claude is the AI for minds that don't stop at good enough. It's the collaborator that actually understands your entire workflow and thinks with you, whether you're debugging code at midnight or strategizing your next business move. Claude extends your thinking to tackle the problems that matter. For problems worth solving, get started with Claude at claude.ai/PMP. That's claude.ai/PMP, and check out Claude Pro, which includes access to all the features mentioned in today's episode.
Skincare has gotten so complicated between all the retinols, vitamin C serums, primers, repair creams, snail extracts. At some point, most of us realize our skin isn't keeping up the way we'd like. That's what OneSkin changed for me. It wasn't just looking for something that might work better than my current routine. I found something that actually works differently. As we age, some skin cells stop functioning the way they should. And that's what's actually driving those visible signs of aging. And OneSkin's OS1 peptide was specifically engineered to address those. And with summer here, that matters even more because up to 80% of visible skin aging starts with sun exposure. But OneSkin's new limited edition summer bundles have you covered. It's their skincare and SPF essentials paired together. So the OS1 peptide is helping to reverse the visible effects of UV aging while you're getting SPF protection from new damage. When I tried the OS1 face moisturizer and essential eye cream, I saw immediate results. Over time, my skin felt balanced and moisturized, but never greasy. And this isn't just my experience. OneSkin's results are backed by 4 peer-reviewed clinical studies, over 10,000 5-star reviews. Born from over a decade of longevity research, OneSkin is helping you unlock your healthiest skin now and as you age. For a limited time, try OneSkin with 15% off using code PMP at oneskin.co/PMP. That's 15% off oneskin.co with code PMP. After you purchase, they'll ask you where you heard about them. Please support our show and tell them we sent you.
It seems not on point with a fantasy premise to question whether something is realistic. Al and I just had this discussion about fantasy, and I feel like this franchise breaks the rules, you know, is bad fantasy in a certain way, in that it sort of got worse over the films. That the first film, until the climax, until the end, it's sort of like, what a big, you know, I have to get all the way downstairs. look at the length of my legs. How hard is it to get downstairs? And so a lot of the humor was just how ineffectual the things that they were trying to do. Let's hook all the monkeys together and lower them over the side. Okay, that's like 18 inches that they can get down. But then by a few movies later, they're easily able to save a toy in the street from the window by using the slinky and the monkeys. And yeah, just these impossibilities of physics.
They're leaping across like carnival rides.
Right. So it was already kind of the climactic scene in the first movie with the remote control car and just defying the laws of physics all over the place. But okay, that's fine. I wasn't sure then, like with the last movie where we combine, now not only like toys can't really get lost because they have a GPS toy and they have a camera toy and they can in real time send photos in a way that I'm trying to think of one of those like hostage, you know, real... I've got a certain set of skills. Those kind of movies. If you were
Taken, yeah.
You know, rescuing the person based on, I can take little pictures out the window and I happen to catch perfectly the street sign. And so in real time, you can use your... Is that even on point?
It's kind of creepy for a kid's toy, by the way. I don't think I'd want my daughter with that.
Is it on point to say that? Like, I don't buy it. All these freaking, you're upgraded. Now you can fly, you know?
Right. Just, right.
The fact that the toilet, why did the toilet training toy have internet connectivity? What? Messaging in the toilet training toy?
I'm with you all the way up there, except for the toilet. I want to pick you up on the toilet toy thing. I loved those, the three crappy electronics toys from the mid-90s, because they stood in for a really, really important thing. It also thematically in the film stood in for something really, really important, which is all of these toys represented something which the lily pad can do in its kind of all-in-one, one-stop screen shop thing. You've got these three other little toys, the camera, the GPS, and the toilet training game, which Jesse rightly derides as useless, because we've got, and it was just a wonderful joke about what electronic toys used to, how hyper-specific all these electronics used to be.
Yeah.
And like consequently how short their shelf life was. But I loved the internet connectivity because that was exactly what it was like in like 1997. You get these like stupid little one-use electronics items which had a quote modem in them that you would have to go through extraordinary lengths to actually get any use out of. I thought it was great. There was some stuff in a 90-minute movie, you do hate to see flab, and like the Buzz Lightyear subplot was clearly flab, and I did roll my eyes at the final chase scene where, to your previous point, Mark, there was a whole act, I think, in the first movie, which is about how we're going to get past this dog. And they got past the dog in the final chase scene in, I think, 8 seconds by just going through a slide. So there's a clear, like, upping of the stakes, and we're just asked to go along with it. I can let that go, but you're right. We're getting rid of a lot of what used to provide the tension in the earlier movies.
I think maybe that the thing with the Buzz Lightyears was because really the dynamic between the two main characters was played out. Like, we don't need to see that anymore at all. And we've added, okay, there's the Spanish mode that Buzz had, and you can, just these, there's different things that were introduced in some of the other movies. Woody, I would have been happy if he wasn't in the film at all. I think he did not add anything. I mean, I understand it's the nostalgia, like it's the brand.
You can't keep Tom Hanks if Tom Hanks
is willing to do it.
It did feel slapped on.
There was nothing for him to do. So, but with Buzz, they were just like, okay, we're going to really lean into this and make 50 Buzzes. I know you were annoyed before, but now we're going to have, you know, and now he's able to talk them through what was his existential crisis in a matter of, you know, that took up the whole first movie in a matter of about 10 seconds that he can convince them.
Well, what about Buzz all of a sudden wanting to marry Jesse?
That was seeded in earlier movies. They did have a romance. Yeah,
it was.
I did not like it. That I could have done without that.
Why not?
Why was he? He was like stalking her the entire movie. I didn't like it, and she did not seem interested at all. There didn't seem any kind of romantic tension there. The only seemed so one sided
until she saw his Spanish version in Toy Story 3. Then she was like,
she was interested. Then, yeah.
That was what, back in 2010 or something? Come on. The ship has sailed.
He's been friend-zoned since then.
Friend-zoned, exactly.
Did we want more sexual double entendres that the kids wouldn't get, given the duel?
No, we're good.
And you know what? I could also have done, this is the other like problem with the Woody thing. They have all these half-assed Woody's an old man now jokes, which I could have also done without. One of them was that he got fat. How does a toy get fat?
He's overstuffed.
It's a great question. Do toys eat? Do they eat?
They do not eat.
I had a baby this and that who did eat.
I think this should have been,
by the way,
something to explore.
I remember my cousin had like a thing that it would eat and it would pee, some kind of little doll or something.
That's a lot. Why did this not show up in one of these films?
Absolutely.
I don't know if they're called Wetzelot.
I think you made that name though, Mark.
They were called stuff like Baby Shits Itself though. It was really it was really nasty for a while there in the
It was very on the nose.
Kids are fascinated by natural bodily functions. It is a thing.
Yes, of course.
I mean, that's the reason why there's fart jokes in almost all kid movies.
Yeah. There are a lot of poop jokes in this one, by the way.
They had in one of the films, like in a fake post-credit scene, I think it was two.
Yeah.
Post-credits bloopers.
Yes.
Somebody's farting in one of them. Oh,
Kelsey Grammer. Yeah. Yes,
right.
I actually really enjoyed those post-credit scenes, if I'm being honest.
They did that back in the first one, too. Yeah, I thought it was great.
Of course they were scripted, because of course there's no real... Although maybe there could have been, audio stuff. Anyway, but I was really taken aback by how much I enjoyed those post-credit scenes. That's probably some of the best stuff in Toy Story, if I'm being completely honest. At least short stuff.
I think I enjoyed it the first time. I think seeing it the second time, I was kind of cringing a little bit. But
did you stay for the post-credit scenes in 5?
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
I don't remember what they were, but... We don't have to.
There was a lonely little boy, and then the Buzz Lightyear squadron descended on the playground.
Yeah, you'll get friends. I thought that was a good payoff at the end.
I mean, it's you got to do something with those characters to.
I don't think I would say it was a good payoff so much as like necessary housekeeping that you have to do if you've introduced 50 Buzz Lightyear dolls into the plot.
Well said. Yes, yes, yes.
What do we think about just the main conceit of the whole thing that? When you're not looking, they move, but yet they want nothing more than to be moved by the children. So it's a weird, like, pseudo slavery kind of, you could be shipped off, you could be separated from your loved ones, you could be thrown away. It's an entirely one-sided relationship, but you got to just be there for them. And of course, some of the toys are not on board with this. Their hearts have been crushed before, or they never knew the love of a child. So they're not, what do we think of this whole, and I was confused in this new one where the Buzz Lightyears, they were approached by people and they just collapse. Like it's a biological imperative, don't move. But in the first movie, the climax with Sid is like, we're going to have to break some of the rules. We're going to have to move in front of the kid just to scare the shit out of him. So what's the deal? Can they move? How are these rules enforced? Am I asking too many questions?
I think you're asking too many questions. Also, Sid was such an existential threat that I think they had to in order to kind of, combat whatever Sid was doing. Because Sid was like an evil fucking kid.
Yeah.
But I think around normal people who are not like Sid level evil, they try to adhere to the rules. But that's how I read it. I don't know if I read that right, though.
Unless they don't know they're being seen. They walk, a pretty funny scene in number 2, where they're going to the toy store and they're under cones and they cause a giant traffic pileup. People died because of their antics. And it was pretty funny.
Did we see dead bodies? I don't know if we saw dead bodies.
I don't think that was the implied. I think everyone's okay. A lot of auto damage and insurance pain in the ass was caused by these damn toys going out in public.
I was thinking about your broader point, because like the conceit of the franchise is really beautiful. Like just toys are alive and they really want to be toys. They care a great deal about their purpose. And like your point about like that's all they want at the expense of their own, autonomy and well-being or whatever it is. All they want is to fulfill this purpose and be good for their children. Yeah, read a certain way, that's difficult and you're casting them as slave people. But on the other hand, when you're a kid and you're watching that, what I think that teaches you to do is to value your toys and think they are like they're trying for me and I should respect that effort.
Agreed.
And when I watch these movies, I don't feel like I feel bad for locking my toys away because they're like sentient and I'm neglecting them. I feel bad for locking my toys away because they were important to me and I should honor that.
In number 4, they sort of established like free toys. We no longer have to be enslaved to our potentially cruel masters like Sid. If you're lucky, you get an Andy, you get a Bonnie or whatever.
Or a preschool.
Yes, we're not age appropriate. That was a particularly funny bit in number 3.
Yeah, I mean, there have been stories before where the toys come to life. And I think that's something they were sort of hitting on, something that has already been in the imaginations of children. But it hits on who you are, what your purpose is in life, and who you see yourself as. And those are all really important messages, I think, to teach to young kids, like what the hell am I doing here? Those are all really important existential questions to ask of such young kids. And I think it's kind of brilliant that Pixar is having them examine themselves in this way through a cartoon, essentially.
Does it prompt the humans to examine their own telos of what their inborn nature is? That we have this whole thing between, you know, convincing Buzz Lightyear that he is in fact not a space ranger with some external purpose, that he is merely a toy and to be happy, you know, being what you were made to be. There's certainly no sense that the humans were merely made to be a certain way and they should act their place or something like that. Like we don't extend those lessons. So it's a strange thing to present.
It is.
To children with different existential rules.
They hammer that home every single movie. Like that's the theme basically of every single movie, is each character is asking, what the hell am I doing here? What the hell am I doing here if my job is to play and then my human grows up and doesn't need me anymore and I'm abandoned? Or they grow up and I'm put in a box and stuffed in the attic? Or I'm abandoned and donated to a preschool where I'm not treated very well. But they're still asking the same question. I feel like they're asking the same question. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm totally getting this whole franchise incorrectly. But it feels like they're asking the same question every single movie.
I don't know if how much research they did in Toy Story 3 into what it is like at a garbage dump. And is
oh my God.
Nightmare hell. I could imagine really freaking some kids out with that fiery pit of doom.
It was a twofer too. At first you're like, oh, my heart just been ripped out of my chest. Like, thank God they're going to be okay. Oh my God. No, now there's fire. That movie absolutely destroyed me. I think I left the movie theater probably 5 pounds lighter.
Yeah, that incinerator scene.
Holy crap.
Traumatized a generation.
That was intense.
Yeah. It was pretty intense.
Scary toys, right? They have a little bit of fun with dolls being spooky. And so we get in Toy Story 3, a sort of recreation of the Darth Vader and Emperor scene where the baby toy that was sort of the scariest among them. And we have this in the first film with all Sid's monstrosities that it turns out, oh, actually, they're just a nice little tight-knit community that takes care of each other, even though they're freaks that he has constructed, you know. But he's actually seemed a pretty creative kid, frankly. Going through the countdown to his, it seems like he had a good imagination. You know, it's just involved M80s and things, which isn't crazy for a kid of a certain age.
So are you defending Sid? Is that what's happening here?
He clearly was neglected. He slept in his jeans. I noticed in the credits that he plays in, I guess, Toy Story 3, when they're grown up, that he plays like the garbage man or something. It's Sid. The character of Sid is in there as, I think, one of the people with the garbage trucks. Like, because
that's awesome. I didn't know that.
That's what he would grow up to be.
What about Gabby and those ventriloquist dummies in Toy Story 4? Like, I found those terrifying. I'm like, I don't want, I'm not going to sleep tonight.
I mean, they're playing with horror tropes, but I thought it was relatively cute, if I'm being honest.
Cute?
Wasn't disturbed by it at all. Yeah.
I guess it's no surprise that those dolls are going to give me nightmares.
Yeah, the nonchalance in which they were following the car that had left them at a rest stop, that was another place where I felt like they don't have a GPS in this one. They're too easily able to, oh, it's okay. You know, oh, yes. And there's the height of when they are sort of take control of the vehicle so they can, you know, have this rendezvous and they, you know, drive this again, causing potentially catastrophic. If one of those toys killed a person because of their antics in taking over the control system of a car, I don't know if I could go with this. I think at some point you'd have to just sign off of this, that's the moral infractions that are going on here. The risk.
Yeah, it's very irresponsible.
You said these, Sarah, I think that this sort of had been out there of your toys come to life. Like, what were the presages of this and the legacy of this? Like, what?
Well, Well, I mean, I think the classic is a Velveteen Rabbit, you know, but it's usually like the toys want to become real. Like that's what their goal is. And so they are sentient. They are, you know, they do have these minds of their own. And when the humans are away. So I like the twist that the toys actually are happy just being toys, except for, I guess, Buzz Lightyear at first. But they're fine with the skin that they're in or the plastic that they're in. So I kind of like that twist. But yeah, there's a whole history of toys that come to life. And I even remember watching, was it Raggedy Ann and Andy cartoons or something when we were young? Oh, yeah. Do you remember that, Mark?
Definitely, yeah.
They would come to life when the kids would be away. So they would come to life in the playroom.
We had Rosie and Jim. Similarly, it was a kids' TV. There were a couple of Raggedy dolls who lived on a canal boat. And then when the owners left, they would come away and have adventures. And obviously, I was thinking of Winnie the Pooh, too. But that's a slightly different case where you have, like, the secret imaginary adventures of characters based on toys. And it's not a case of, like, toys coming to life.
That's an idea that's been around for a very long time. And I think that Toy Story is the best at exploring that. But the moment you start going just an inch deeper into the logic of it and how does that work and how does it work in the world, it completely falls apart. And so what Toy Story does, it allows us to kind of play in this world and kind of, you know, suspend our disbelief and just kind of play with it. Because the moment you start applying real life logic to it, it just doesn't work. It doesn't work at all. It completely falls apart. If I walk into a room and my toy was here, and then I walk back into the room and the toy's over here, we're leaving. We're moving out of this house. You know, it's over. You know, so I'm not. So that's what I'm saying. Like, I enjoy Toy Story for what it is. I enjoy going into the world. I play in the world when I'm there, but I understand that that is a world over here that my logic that I have in this world should not be applied to that world. Because just if 0.1% of what happens in that world happens in this world, I'm leaving my house. I might be leaving the earth. I don't want to be here anymore living in a world where that's possible. So you just kind of have fun with it.
I mean, an awful lot of the plot does revolve around the fact that parents are more than happy to accept that a toy that they've misplaced has just turned up somewhere it couldn't possibly have been. And just get on with their lives. Like, these parents through the Toy Story movies are clearly very, very tired, which strikes me as accurate.
It is accurate, but like, if you were just to change the music of Toy Story, it's a horror movie.
That's kind of what I was trying to get at. Right. I think a lot of the presages of this and the subsequent ones have been, did we talk about Living Doll? I mean, we talked to sort of the Pinocchio thing in general and how, right, that there's a lot of nightmare fuel involved in this, you know, and horror movies about, I think we talked about having an episode about like imaginary friends and other stuff like that. And it never turns out well. So I guess having, it sort of goes with like the kid wanting their toys to be alive. Like, I wish my dog could talk. It's a very similar kind of thing. And so it's a fantasy that like, oh, they really are. And they really love you. And they really, but they're just, they don't want to freak you out. Like, I feel like there should have been a discussion about that even before the let's actually freak Sid out by doing this. Like, tell Forky, you know, one of the more naive toys, like, yeah, you don't want to be nightmare fuel. Just chill out.
I mean, because these toys could easily turn into Chucky very easily, very quickly.
Or Megan.
Or Megan, and you don't want to go that route. So let's keep it cute.
I was let down by my owner. Now I will wreak vengeance on
exactly. Anyone who resembles it could be real bad. Like, real
that
bad.
Wasn't that the plot of Toy Story 3?
That's Toy Story 2, isn't it?
I don't think Jesse was trying to wreak vengeance on.
No, Prospector Pete.
Oh, Prospector Pete. Well, but the bear.
Oh, he was. That's right. That's right. He was trying to reach.
No, it's the bear. It's the bear at number three.
Oh, the bear. No,
I'm thinking of the bear at number three. Yeah.
Okay.
That's but Prospector Pete, he was not a nice toy and apparently very gassy.
And honestly, I would like to explore in the world of Toy Story what happens when a toy breaks bad, like hardcore breaks bad, and not just tries to like mess things up, but like tries to kill their owner. Like, let's go there. But of course, I'm a horror movie guy, so maybe no one else is on board with that.
And you wouldn't have to break any IP. So this is the thing. Like, it seems like this series should just stop.
Mm-hmm.
and maybe should have stopped a couple movies ago. But, you know.
I mean, but the movies still are still good, though.
They're making quality stuff.
Yes, but like the movie is still good. And so it's hard to say it needs to stop if the movie, like if the movie quality went down.
If these are just the rules of the universe, then any toys belonging to anyone in any part of the world is a potential Toy Story. Like it's the most generic possible name. Toy Story Japan. Toy Story 2050. You could have, you don't have to have Buzz and you know, these particular, one of the reviews was talking about how they represented different eras of manhood, right? The cowboy versus the spaceman, and was, you know, casting it like that. Yeah, play with other symbolism of why particular toys are appealing to kids. What is it that they're trying to get at? Mm. It just seems like this is too small a world to just focus on these handful of people as the actors keep dying, which is depressing to me. I don't want to. I don't want to have this go on after Tom Hanks is dead.
It seemed to be one of the things that this movie was trying to do, because a lot's been made of the fact that like Tim Allen and Tom Hanks were all over the publicity for this thing, and they are barely in that. Like they're peripheral to the movie at best. So maybe one of the things this movie was trying to do is say, okay, we'll still pretend that Tom Hanks is a star, so that people will definitely go and see this movie, but let's wait and see if people still like it, even though they're peripheral. And then maybe the next, I can see Toy Story 6 having a cameo from both of these characters and not like anything else. Tom Hanks, bless him, is clearly over it. Like Tim Allen doesn't have any other work, but Tom Hanks doesn't need to do this anymore.
I mean, he still likes getting those checks, though, I'm sure.
He still likes getting those checks. And it's nice that his brother keeps getting the voiceover work, but, you know, really, Tom Hanks doesn't need checks. He needs a break.
I've seen too much Annie Potts in real life for her to be, like, the sexy Bo Peep on screen. Like, she's quite elderly. Like, that sort of
thing. I love that character. And I love how she was animated. I was watching just the way that they animate plastic, and she's porcelain, and how she looks so much different from the other toys. I was just like, how do they do that? It feels like magic to me.
Yes. Again, the 3D thing, I'd really recommend that to people, because it is like you could just show me these characters. They don't have to be off in adventures, but just having them around doing their daily stuff, that's okay for me. And I like the whole idea of how they organize themselves and have little meetings and have little dramas and just dance around, and like how they kill time, that they don't seem to just be bored out of their minds unless they're like locked in a trunk, and then it's just emotionally scarring in a way that we don't even want to really show kids. We just want to refer to it.
I want to comment on something that you said, Mark, because I think you're being a little ageist, because Annie Potts is absolutely able to be sexy. Okay. Like, just because she's 70-something doesn't mean that sex disappears. Let her be sexy at 70.
Thank you, Lawrence. That is the right thing to say.
We already, it's like you've never seen The Substance at all.
Do we think that that Forky has a wonderful an idea that kids can make their own toys, and that he has a telos to be trash and has to be explained to him that he actually is a toy? I think that was the most brilliant thing about number four. But that toy is not sticking around 4 years later.
Absolutely.
That toy was thrown.
It's going to fall apart. Yeah. It's something bad's going to happen to that toy.
I know. I thought that was so funny, though, because that came right around the time when the kids were actually making art out of trash art. Did they do that?
I think it's your kids make pipe trash cleaners. Art. Yeah.
It's a thing. It's a definitely thing. A thing.
It's been a thing for a while, but anyway.
But honestly, I mean, I think we need to comment on the high quality of these toys. Mm. I mean, because they are very durable, because the toys that I played with, man, those things would fall apart, and like my little Transformers would fall apart after a year. These things are very durable. How long has it been? 10 years plus? Very durable toys. I'm really impressed with the craftsmanship and the quality of the toy, especially with how hard they're playing and all the hijinks they've been up to. Very impressive.
Yeah.
Yeah, they've been outside. They've been in the rain.
Yeah. Like, really quality toys.
The lithium batteries on those Buzz Lightyears are amazing.
Amazing. Amazing.
There is tragedy. It's just we don't get to see it. Like, for sure, Wheezy with that squeaker, I mean, it's a piece of crap little rubber toy in the first place. That thing got thrown right in the garbage. And those soldiers are like, yeah, we're getting out of here. We're for sure not going to get donated. We're going to be in the trash.
Yeah, good call.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of implications of, and I kind of liked in number three, like, yeah, we've lost people over the years, including Bo Peep, and we're just the survivors, but they just can't let any tragedy lie in these movies such that, you know, oh, actually Bo Peep has, you know, ran off and she's been living a wonderful life. And now we have to reunite with her for the whole fourth movie and make this a major theme. And then what did you guys think about, so this is a big spoiler for the new movie, but oh, even though Jesse's original owner outgrew her and donated her, we're going to paper over that tragedy and discover that actually she named her child after this toy. And it was the most, you know, that really shows that, and she just happened to run across this evidence of this. I don't know.
That was not only kind of not very good, but it was also thematically orthogonal in a really annoying way, because the story is about Bonnie not being able to make friends.
Mm-hmm.
And the story is about the different ways that toys and play can make that easier or harder on a kid, especially a kid who doesn't naturally fit in. Jessie's the main character, so you have to give her some kind of arc that's related to that. But the one that they came up with just retreads exactly her arc from the earlier movies, mm-hmm. where she agreed. Has to come to terms mm-hmm. with and
yeah, agree.
I don't know why they didn't do something different, because it's not like there weren't other available stories there.
And yet, I was crying. I was still crying. I was like, I fall for it every time. Like, I still cried. Yeah, that's how
I know. And in the background, they have the fucking piano melody When Somebody Loved Me. And you just...
Yeah.
It's so should we be upset with Toy Story, with them manipulating us the way that they do? Like, no. Is that something that we should be upset about? Or should we
just... It's what they do. It is a tight production machine, and they know what they're doing.
That mm-hmm. Randy Newman is still involved. Actually, I was a little annoyed. I wish that Taylor Swift had co-written that song with Randy Newman. I would have liked it better rather than just like, oh, we got to have Taylor Swift do it. But anyway, but he wrote that Sarah McLachlan sang, that When Somebody Loved Me. I didn't realize there was more Randy Newman songs in the first one. You know, like, oh, the changes affecting me, where the Buzz Lightyear paraphernalia is all over the wall. There were like three or four different distinct Randy Newman songs in that first one, and it seemed like it backed off. But it's just they've been very lucky that even in, so it's not been the same director every time, but the one this time,
Andrew Stanton
has mm-hmm. been involved, was a writer
yeah.
in the previous ones, and he did WALL-E and Finding Nemo, and you know, so like they're still using pretty top drawer talent. So it's not quite the same as these other long-standing things like the Halloween franchise or whatever that just necessarily like went to different creators. Obviously, this is going to do that. You know, maybe we're thinking of the same thing in terms of the, okay, Woody and Buzz can just have smaller and smaller parts. Maybe, you know, some of the veterans in the production side can have smaller and smaller, or, you know, some of the people that were new this time, well, they'll be the, you know, the ones in charge next time, unless it just goes to somebody totally different. I noticed this, there was Lord and Miller involved on the executive producer side. I'm like, okay. Oh, no, I'm sorry. I'm misremembering that. That was on The Sheep Detectives that I saw.
Yes. I haven't seen that. Is it? I want to watch it.
It's quite good.
I quite enjoy Sheep Detective, surprisingly. Yeah.
It seems like one of the strengths of the Toy Story franchise is they do get this really good, like when you say behind the camera, it's animation, you know what I mean? This really good production or writing talent.
Mm-hmm.
And they seem to go through it, because you do get different, like you get different writers, you get different directors on each film. I think that does keep it fresh. It means you do get the new take. And it probably also means, like as Lawrence and I were kind of gesturing at earlier, Toy Story should continue, but it needs to only continue when there's like a reason to make a new one.
Yeah.
And right. to do that, you need to bring on the fresh director. You don't pull out like whoever wrote the second one or try and like pull Joss Whedon back. You need to get someone who has something new to say about the franchise, which is what they did.
And I think that the time between the movies is actually quite helpful for the movies to be good.
Mm.
Because if you're cranking them out every 2 years, every 3 years, it's going to get stale. But the fact that they're taking their time, and there's like 5 years, 6 years, 7 years between one installation. Man, I'm sick. Between one film and another film, right?
There are art installations, yes.
I'm being hoity-toity.
Ai Weiwei is going to be directing the next one.
Shut up, Aaron. Anyway, but the point, though, is that the fact that they take their time, it allows the ideas to cook. It allows them to think about the new iterations of toys and to think about smart reactions to them. I think that is really, really good. Now, I am starting to get on board with Mark because I feel the same way about Scream movies. I think that Nev Campbell needs to go. Like, I would like for them to kind of do something different because we love the characters. We love the voice actors. But if they're smart enough, they can come up with good characters, new characters, a new world. I would like to see something different because it's starting to get a little stale. The world's international now. Go to Japan. Go to Germany. Go to Africa. Mm-hmm. Go look at the way other people play and how you kind of, you know, make stories surrounding different forms of play. I think it's time to do that. You know, Mark has a point there. And one thing, like, once Tom Hanks goes, this franchise has to end. Like, there is no way to continue this without Tom Hanks.
The way it is now.
Yeah, I guess you're right. Yeah. I mean, I guess you can go to another world.
I think the franchise goes without Tom Hanks because, like, I did not care about him being in this movie.
You could recast the voice with anybody.
He is so central to it. I don't know.
They're cartoon characters, right?
But one of the problems with the movies as they've gone is that there are so many characters, which I think is why there are so many different plots that don't really go anywhere or are totally unneeded. And Buzz as a character for the past two movies has been pretty peripheral. I mean, he hasn't really had a ton to do. It almost just seems like he's Buzz Lightyear, so he has to be in it. You know, Woody is, you know, the reason why Toy Story exists, so he has to be in it. So it feels like, and then we've collected all of these toys over the years, and they're still there. Even when the voice actor, we have Mr. Potato Head is still there, even though the original voice actor is dead.
You know? Jim Varney died, they should have gotten rid of that damn Slinky dog. That thing would break. Like, the Slinkies do not last like that. They just stretch
out. No, or it would be totally like, that takes a week, by the way. Anybody who's had a Slinky, it takes a week for it to get all wonky.
I just want John Hamm to play Hamm. Just recast the core cast just as jokes.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's sort of remarkable that we have a politically diverse group of people, right? That Tim Allen and John Ratzenberger are both like pretty bad Trumpy characters in real life, but yet they're still living in this nice society. I guess I didn't realize until I rewatched the movie how much internal animosity there was, you know, how Don Rickles was actually mean and how they thought, you know, Woody was a murderer for a third of the movie. Because it's like, you know, it's been pretty peaceful other than whoever the new invader is since then. I think we've said way more than we should. There is to say about these films.
I agree.
Thanks for hanging around with us, audience, panel. So long.
Bye, guys.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you.
Pretty Much Pop is part of the Partially Examined Life podcast network. Get more Pretty Much Pop at prettymuchpop.com. Get bonus content for every episode at patreon.com/prettymuchpop.